Pacific Overtures is a 1976 musical written by Stephen Sondheim with a book by John Wideman. It's a sprawling story that takes place over the course of over 100 years, telling the narrative of the westernization of Japan from the perspective of the Japanese. Well, it's supposedly from the perspective of the Japanese, but it was also written by white Americans, and don't worry, we talk about that. Because this musical has such an evolved plot, we also give a full summary of what happened in the episode, so I'm not going to get into that too much here. For now, let me just say it was an incredibly ambitious show with an immensely involved score and a huge cast, and closed after 6 months despite being nominated for 10 Tony Awards. My guest today is director and Pacific Overtures enthusiast Aaron Roberts. I hope you enjoy our conversation about Pacific Overtures. Hello, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm great. What are we talking about today?
So today we're talking about an extremely popular musical that everyone knows, Pacific Overtures.
Just, you know, it's the Hamilton of its time,
it
really.
It really was.
So why did you choose this musical?
Great. So when I got the list of, like, we're looking for people to talk about shows, I saw Pacific Overtures, and that, like, jumped out at me because I'm a Sondheim stan. And I've read both books about all of his works, and I found Pacific Overtures in my, like, rebellious teen musical phase where I was like, I'm not going to like the musicals the cool kids like. I'm going to like the musicals that I like. And because I grew up in a rural area, not close to any major urban cities where tours were coming through, or I didn't have access to Broadway itself, I had to, like, find musicals online. So I did a lot of, like, adding movie musicals to my Blockbuster On Demand queue, much to the chagrin of my family. And then I just, like, went on YouTube and just, like, looked at Tony clips and, like, found bootlegs, like, rip bootlegs. But, you know, I did what I could. And there's a fantastic recording of this whole show that was done for Japanese public television in the 70s. And it's on YouTube now. And so I clicked on it because I was like, oh, wow, a full musical. Like, great, cool, what's this about? And then I watched it, and I was like, this is unlike any other piece of musical theater I've ever seen. I don't know what just happened. Like, there's so much to process, so much to look into, but I'm into it. Like, the storytelling is really unique and compelling, and the soundtrack does not sound like anything else you've ever heard. So I was like, I have to learn more about this. And so I watched it again, and I listened to the cast album, and I, like, looked up on Wikipedia, and I just, like, dug into it, and I, like, researched it more. And I've really come to, like, regard it as, like, an excellent piece of musical theater, and, like, one of the ways that Sondheim distinguished himself from other writers of musical theater at the time, because it continues to, like, throw expectations at the audience. And, like, it premiered in 1976, which was the bicentennial of America. Everybody was pretty pro-USA at the moment. And this is a musical that really looks at the consequences of America forcing themselves onto a nation that asked them to leave and didn't want them to be there. And so he's really pushing this counter-narrative, like he's done with Company, where he's, like, pushing a counter-narrative about marriage and just sort of throwing it in the audience's faces, which as a teen I was, like, into. I was like, yeah, they're going to just, like, come to see a regular musical and you're going to tell them no and you're going to, like, show them something real. But as I sort of matured and learned a lot more, especially about a lot of, like, the racial politics in this show, I've really come to look at it as, like, an early example of some of the ways that we think about, like, proper representation in media and art in general.
There is so much good stuff there mm-hmm. that we are going to dive into over the next hour or so. I want to start with, like, a brief preface of my experience with the show, which
totally.
Was very little. I sort of heard of it because I like Sondheim, and so I've kind of, like, had a passing familiarity with a lot of his works, but mm-hmm. I'd never sat down and listened to it before you picked this one. And it's funny because you say that, like, it doesn't sound like anything else, which is true in a way, but I also was like, well, this is a Sondheim score, so there's
yeah.
that. And I also just, like, we're going to have a very serious conversation about, like, the very interesting geopolitical ramifications of this
musical. Before that, I just want to say that I was thinking a lot about the History of Japan video while listening to this.
Fully. Like, when that video came out, and then I was like, oh, my God, this is about the time. And then it was just like, the economic prosperity, blah, 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 blah. And America shows up, and I'm like, oh, I've studied for this part of the exam. Like, I know what's about to happen. Yeah.
Yep, that was, it's literally like, it's a 10-second clip in the History of Japan video is this entire musical.
This entire 2.5-hour extravaganza.
It's amazing. Yeah.
And also, while we're on this topic of, like, geopolitical implications of this piece of work, I just want to say, for listeners at home, like, we're both two white people who are, like, doing our best to do the reading before we come to talk about this podcast that is largely about the Japanese experience. So just be generous in your response to this, and if we say something where we put our foot in our mouth, like, that's on us, and we're going to do better.
Absolutely. And, of course, we always welcome feedback. Those links and everything in the description, and as well as links listed out in the end of the show. So, you know, let us know and tell us what you think about this episode, always.
Yeah, because I don't want to be walking around talking about things that I think are great about this if they're, like, truly tragic to a group of people I've overlooked.
Well said.
So the book writer, John Wideman, who's worked with Stephen Sondheim before on Company, had this play, which was sort of traditional in terms of, like, realistic, just, like, follow the events as they unfurl, about the Perry expedition to Japan, which was an expedition in the 1850s where the U.S. sent a delegation of its military, its navy, to Japan with, like, gifts and trading agreements and letters from the president as a way of opening up the country, because for 250 years up to that point, Japan had been extremely isolated from the rest of the world. There was a decree from the shogun, who's, like, the military powerful governing leader of Japan, who, like, banished all foreigners and, like, got everybody who wasn't Japanese out of the islands, and was like, Japan is for Japanese people who live in the Japanese way, in the Japanese culture, and no one else. You can't leave. If you leave and you talk to foreign people, you can't come back. Like, you're banished. You're going to be put to death. Don't do it. And that had pretty much been the law of the land for about 250 years. Meanwhile, the rest of the nation, you know, 1850s, mechanisms, like, in Industrial Revolution, like, the world keeps turning on. And so Admiral Perry was this Navy general who came on behalf of the U.S. They told the Japanese people they wanted to trade with them. The Japanese people said, no, thank you. And then they said, well, we've come all this way. We also have these cannons, these guns, gunboats. And we would really like it if you traded with us. Wink. And they were like, okay, we see your point. And then they made some concessions. And then they made some more concessions. And then, before you know it, Japan was officially open to the entire world, began trading, began, like, being industrious, like, began being more Western, et cetera, et cetera. Japan as we know it today. So the book writer, John Wideman, wrote this play about this specific happening where the ship comes to the harbor and Japanese delegation receives them and chaos ensues. And he brought it to Hal Prince, noted director, producer, and collaborator, and Hal was like, I like it. I think it needs to be opened up in a way that a musical can be. I know this guy. You may have heard of him, Stephen Sondheim. Stephen gets in the room. He talks to John. They're like, okay, yeah, let's make this a musical. So then they start writing. It premieres in 1976 on Broadway. Critically mixed. Lots of people were like, it's definitely a tremendous amount of work. It's, like, special in a lot of ways that we haven't seen before. Do we particularly enjoy the 2.5 hours we just spent in the Winter Garden Theater? No. Wasn't much of a tourist draw in the way that, like, Phantom would become or Hello, Dolly was. So got it nominated for every award in the book, kind of like Sondheim had a track record for doing, and Hal Prince at the time, but never really captured the public fascination. And then it's received a couple of notable revivals since. Also, just, like, they have produced most recently an off-Broadway revival that strips the book down to about 90 minutes and cuts some of the songs, sort of just streamlining the whole show. And that starred George Takei as the narrator character. So famous people that we love. mm-hmm. in theater.
Yeah. This is sort of the history of how this got made, sort of piece by piece of bringing these people in. I think it's very interesting because it is sort of a who's who list in, like, the 1970s Broadway community.
It for sure was.
Mm-hmm. And it's like, great, let's do it. Sondheim's on board. We're going to win Tonys and not run for very long.
Yep.
Yeah.
Which is, like, both exciting for a musical theater nerd like me and also just one of the things that still concerns me about the piece now is that, like, if this piece were getting made today... And we have sort of a reference for this with the musical Allegiance, which is another musical about the Japanese-American experience, in a way. The Japanese-American experience, in this case, versus Pacific Overtures, where it is Japan and then the new American experience. They would try to involve people who were Japanese in more creative ways, like the composer of Allegiance is a Japanese man, and it was produced by George Takei, who also starred in it. And there was just a lot more involvement top down of mm-hmm. like people for whom this play was representing. And the thing that still like gives me a little bit of pause when I think about the show now, even though I really, really enjoy it and I think it stands for a lot of good, is that it was produced and monetized by and written by straight white dudes, mostly, excepting Steve, because like... We love them.
There was a hand gesture there that you didn't
yes,
see.
Yes, I'm sorry. I'm a very visual person. For the listeners at home, I just snapped my fingers to indicate that Steve is a lovable, notable homosexual. Steve, I know him very well, personally.
Yeah, my first friend. Name basis, mm-hmm. nicknames.
My friend Steve. Mm-hmm. So yeah, in one way, it's like, oh, yeah, you get the best people who are writing musical theater at the time to write this new musical, totally. But another way, it's like, oh, you got the same three white dudes who have been writing musical theater to write this musical that is notably different in a lot of ways from the other musicals on Broadway.
I mean, if there's one thing we know about white men writing Broadway musicals, it's that they love writing about Asian countries.
They love it. And there's so much in like the musical theater broader sense that is like, yep, if you are a noted person who writes for the musical stage, like Rodgers and Hammerstein, Puccini, like you have something in your work that is like, oh, and now I'm going to do the Asian musical. And it is just like, the farther back in time you go, the cringier and cringier it gets.
Mm-hmm.
And on the one hand, it creates canonization for like Asian actors and like shows about an Asian experience, which is like, generally speaking, great. But on the other hand, it's just like, who profits from this? And also, what are you saying about this experience? Did you live this experience? Is it honest? How do you know? Like, where does it come from? It just kind of gets murky.
Mm-hmm.
And I still to this day, like when I listen to Pacific Overtures, I love it for the piece of art that it is, but I am still uneasy about the creation of it and like the politics behind like who gets to benefit from this piece of art in the world.
That's a very good way to put it, because I think that there's sort of two levels on which we examine these kinds of works when it's like someone from the outside, especially someone who is in a greater position of power mm-hmm. that is writing about an experience that is not theirs. And it's on one question is like, is the representation honest, as you say? Like, one, is it in good faith? And also, is it actually accurate at the end of the day?
Yeah.
Two different things. I think accuracy is, I think good faith is great.
Yep.
Accuracy is ultimately what matters.
It's very important.
And then there's, but there, even beyond that, there's the meta level of like, even if you do go out and make this like very accurate good faith work, there's still, one, I think that like it's just a fact that you're never going to be able to make something that is 100% as honest and impactful as it could be if it was written by someone who lived that experience.
Totally.
That's not to say that you can't make great works like that, but that like there is just a threshold that is going to be reached.
Yeah.
And there's also the question of, say, like, who is profiting from this? And I think that, like, even at the end of the day, even if it's like this is an amazing piece of work and it is – and we'll dive into like the different ways this is and isn't like good representation from our perspective. But it's still like, well, then you are profiting off the story of a very painful story of a group and a people that you are not a part of.
And also like a story about Americans profiting off Japanese people like
yeah.
already. So it's like, in one way, it's actually fitting that this musical was written by like American white dudes, because it's like, that's the whole history of this event in the first place is that American white dudes were like, you know what we need? A slice of that Japanese economic market. And then they went in there and they took it.
Mm-hmm. And I also, the note sort of like of these people being like the who's who of Broadway and Sondheim and Halperin's and all that. And it's like, that is how these power structures get replicated. Because if Sondheim started writing this and was like, I want a Japanese director for this.
Right.
Like, that could have been huge for that director's career.
Totally.
But instead, it's Hal Prince, because Hal Prince is the director, mm-hmm. and Hal Prince is the director because he's the one that gets called and self-perpetuates forever.
Yeah. And the thing is that, like, is a little bit frustrating for me is that the show that it existed in 1976 that I've seen from the film is, like, it's remarkable. And we can jump into talking about this show now, but, like, it is, like, truly, like, an homage to the various different kinds of Japanese theatrical traditions, be it kabuki, which is a stage drama with like extreme makeup and fabulous costumes and stylistic portrayals, and bunraku, which is a Japanese puppet tradition that involves three puppeteers for puppets articulating the head and the arms and the legs. Which is, again, just like a nationally or internationally recognized cultural form of expression and theater in Japan. And a little bit of no theater, which is an older Japanese theatrical tradition. So it blends those traditions and the tradition of the American musical to create, like, a really, in my view, compelling and unique expression of what the show is about, which is, like, a traditional Japanese day being taken over by Western forces, and then, like, where do the Japanese people go from there? And the show starts with the narrator, who is a figure from kabuki theater and bunraku puppet theater in particular. In bunraku, there are two artisans, who one of whom plays like a guitar, almost. It's a Japanese string instrument. And the other one is the narrator, and they have the script in front of them, and they voice all the characters, and they give, like, almost like a fully realized acting performance of all of the characters off to the side while the puppeteers are manipulating the puppets on stage. So he begins the show talking about how Japan is this island kingdom floating in the middle of the ocean, and there's nothing that can challenge the serene serenity of their life. They're completely exiled from everyone else, the laws that are in place, and then they go into the structures of, like, how they make rice, how they exchange bows, like, how they make swords, and, like, they just, like, explain a little bit of daily life for the Japanese people at that time, and it is, like, total stasis. Nothing's changing, everything's the same, everyone's happy. And throughout the show, we meet this, like, low-level samurai who gets suddenly promoted to a high-ranking samurai because the shogun, who is the military leaders at the time, have recognized this enormous American ship in their harbor, and they don't want to deal with it because they don't want to be responsible for failing, and they know it's a doomed mission. So they're like, hey, you, nobody, you're in charge now, congratulations. First order of business, deal with these strange people who are here. As luck would have it, there is somebody who left Japan, went to Massachusetts, studied in America for a while, is now back in Japan, about to be killed because you're not allowed to go out of Japan and come back at this time. And so they're like, wait, don't kill him. He can speak English. Put him on the boat with a samurai. And they go to the Americans. They try to negotiate. Famously, Americans not great at saying, no, we're going to do our own way. Thank you very much. And so there's this musical number where the mother of the shogun, who's in charge, poisons him.
Yeah, what is up with this?
So Chrysanthemum Tea is this 9-minute musical number where the shogun continues to ignore the fact that there's, like, an enemy boat in his harbor, and everyone around him is like, it would be really fantastic if you did something about this. Have some tea, my lord, some chrysanthemum tea. And his mother decides she's going to be that somebody who does something about it and poisons him. But he's, like, not dying, so she just poisons him every day with chrysanthemum tea. And, you know, meanwhile, like, his, like, astronomers are telling him the stars are good, he should act. And, like, his soothsayers are saying, like, this is going to be fine. And then there's, like, priests who are saying, oh, the ship doesn't even exist because the sacred law says that no one can come here. And that's the truth. And that's, like, sacred. So they can't actually be here. It's an illusion. Don't worry about it. There's, like, a lot going on. And so eventually he does die. And she's like, okay, well, now that you can't do anything about it, let's get the next person in charge to do something about it. It's fabulous. I listened to that and I'm just like, yes, I'm with her. Like, she she took an opportunity.
What? So hardcore.
Honestly, yeah. I'm a stan. eventually, reason is found among the Japanese delegation. They realize that nothing can be done about the incoming American troops. The low samurai who's been promoted has an idea. Since the decree is very specific that no foreigner can set foot on the soil, they're just going to roll out a bunch of mats on the beach. They're going to build a specially made hut, and then they're just going to walk on the mats, not on the soil. And then they'll have a negotiation. They'll accept the letter. They'll be like, oh, yeah, we're definitely going to show it to the emperor. Uh-huh, for sure we are. You just go back to America, and we'll hit you up in a bit. And then when that is successful, they leave, they roll up the mats, burn them, and then they're like, that's that, act one. Act two, the emperor's like, good on you for, like, getting rid of that. They're never going to come back. I'm happy. I'm the emperor. I'm a puppet. He's literally a puppet.
Yeah. He's like a child emperor, right?
Yeah. They begin the show with being like, oh, yeah, our divine emperor. He's, like, so divine and so smart. He's a year old. It's a bit of, like, a punchline, but, like, truthfully, he's a child. And then throughout the show, he ages into, like, an adult. And that becomes important later. Soon after the emperor congratulates everybody, who would show up but the Americans? And not just the Americans, but the English and the Russians and the Danish and the French. And they're all there to be like, hey, we've heard you're trading now. We would love to get into that. And then the shogun is like, I don't do that. Like, we're not doing that. It's really nice that you came all this way, but no. But they don't take no for an answer. They have this fabulous, again, 9-minute musical number where they're like telling them that they're trading with them. And all of these like offers of trading are punctuated with, we also brought cannons. Boom. And then the shogun's like, okay, yeah, on that consideration, I will trade with you because you have cannons and I don't want to get blown up. Diplomacy. So trading with the West is now acceptable in this small district of Japan. And the samurai has been made governor of this little area. And there's this beautiful number called a bowler hat in Act Two, where it's side by side with the guy who went to Massachusetts, who is now saved. He's just like going back to living in Japan as a Japanese person. He has been promoted to being a samurai because the emperor liked him. And so he's like reinvesting in his Japanese ways and his Japanese culture. Meanwhile, on the other side of the stage, the lowly samurai who was promoted to governor is like getting seduced by all these Western things, like a bowler hat, like a pocket watch, like a cutaway coat. And just like his small writing table becomes like a larger Western style desk with a lamp. And like he's wearing all these clothes and he's really embracing the Westernization of Japan in this way that the person who literally went to the West and came back and was for at the beginning of the play is now like reconsidering and not a fan of anymore. The sailors come into the backyard of our friend who went to Massachusetts but is now a samurai. They hit on his sister basically because they think that she's a geisha and they're sailors and they want to have sex. And so she is rightly horrified. The father is horrified and kills them because he's a samurai and he has a sword. And if he's like, hey, you're going to go onto my property and like try to assault my daughter, I'm going to murder you. And that does not go over well with the emperor or the shogun. And so it goes like all the way up the chain and down the chain again. The shogun is trying to like make peace with the English and because they were English sailors. The Massachusetts guy comes back as a samurai murders him on the road, murders the guy who was the samurai that, like, went to talk to the Americans in the first place, but then got seduced by Western culture, and then goes to the emperor, and he's like, hey, we can kick all these Western people out now that we don't have these people in power. And then the emperor, who was a puppet, takes off his masks, reveals he's the narrator, and says, instead, we're going to embrace Westernization. We're actually going to go all in on this. We are going to ask foreign architects to redesign our cities. We're going to, like, redo our form of government. We are going to, like, lean into this, learn from the Western people. And then once we've got that down, we're going to do the same to China and Korea and the rest of Asia. And we're going to become a well-known superpower on par with all these people. Instead of fighting it, we're just going to go for it. And that's the song next, and that's how the show ends.
Ooh.
So, you know, typical light musical comedy fare.
I want to listen to you summarize every musical.
Oh, my gosh. Thank you. I left a bunch out because there's a lot that happens, but, like, by and large, that's what's happening. And there's a ton of really incredible music. And really, so one of the devices in the show is that the narrator will, like, interrupt the action to deliver a haiku. And every time it happens, it's just so, I mean, haikus are a poetry built on efficiency. And it are just, like, exceptional moments of just, like, cutting to the core of what's happening on stage. And then, like, you watch the rest of the scene with that information in mind. And it's just like, whoa. I see what's happening on, like, so many levels, which is one of my favorite things to happen in theater, is when you understand what's happening on the surface and then on a deeper, like, metaphysical level and on a cultural level. Like, there's just levels on levels on levels.
Mm-hmm. One of the really interesting things in the construction of this musical is that, unlike a lot of the sort of white man writes about Asia musicals in the past, like, Sondheim actually made the effort to build things in, like, a Japanese musical tradition and different theater traditions, like the inclusion of the haikus and the mm-hmm. and the way that he wrote the music itself, because he's Sondheim and he does that, is, like, this very complicated melding of different things in a way that's not just, like, we play a gong in the background sometimes.
Literally, yeah. There's no xylophone and gongs here. He, like, studied the traditions and was, like, he didn't go all the way to the pentatonic scale, which is the five-note musical scale found in Japanese music most often, because that's a little bit limiting to build an entire musical score on five notes in a scale. But he got rid of the leading tone, which, for those of you familiar with The Sound of Music, is T, a Jinkwa Jam and Bread. And he built a lot of the score on parallel fourths, which gives it that quality of sounding like music from Japan without being like, and now it's time for the exotic musical theater number set in Japan, which is one of the reasons why my fears about white people writing the show get sort of assuaged when listening to the scores, because you can tell that it's really thoughtfully written and not just like, well, this kind of sounds like Japanese music. We'll throw some gongs in there, have a xylophone, and, like, bing, bang, boom, Asian music.
You know, the entire continent.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, 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 yeah.
The O word, which we won't say, but, like, that vibe.
A sort of side note with this kind of thing is I also, like, I started listening to this musical and looking up information about it, and I was like, it's not going to be good to women, is it? Oh, no.
No. No. The straight answer is no, it's not good to women. In the original production, all of the roles were played by men mm-hmm. in that kabuki style, and at the very last scene in the song next, women appear on stage and they sing the number.
We're westernized now. Women are allowed here.
Yeah. Like, feminism happened. Didn't know if you heard about it. It's here now. It's great. And so that's one of the reasons why it is so rarely produced, is that, like, not only do you have to have a cast of, like, entirely Asian people, but you have to have a really strong cast of Asian men who are, like, mostly, like, a lot of them are doing women's roles, which is also, like, as we are in 2019, and feminism is the law of the land, mostly in theater circles at least, it is really difficult to be like, we're going to produce a show and hire women as props for the last number, mm-hmm. which is why in most revivals, they don't do that, and women are playing women's roles throughout.
Yeah. But even the women's roles in this show, it's like, well, you know, we have our murderer, mm-hmm. we have a victim.
Yep. have the geishas run by a prostitute.
Yeah.
Like, it's not...
It's not great.
No, it's not great. Which is one of the bummers about this show is that it doesn't... Like, one of the aspects it doesn't really touch on is, like, women's roles and feminism. Again, why it's really hard to produce in a modern time.
This is one of those things I find very interesting about, like, any kind of show or movie or whatever that takes is, like, very historical, especially, like, more, like, war-focused things or, like, this point in time in Japan is, like, yes, like, it is historically accurate that the people in charge were men.
Right.
But, like, women were there.
Totally. Like, just because you're writing a story that happens in a very patriarchal era of time, it doesn't mean that you have to reinforce the patriarchy. And there's literally a song, the second song on the show, called There Is No Other Way, which is where the lowly samurai is talking with his wife about, like, I have to go do this thing that is not going to end well for me. I know it's not going to go well. I'm probably going to die. I don't want to do this, but I have to. That's the, like, the context of the song. And so in the, like, in the stylings of Japanese theater, they have this conversation in dance, in mime, and then two other people come on stage and sing their song for them while they're, like, dancing and getting dressed and what that. And because it is kabuki style and 90% of the cast is male, you literally have a man come on stage and speak for the woman.
Oh,
which,
no.
Which is, like, just the most perfect example of, like, why we need feminism. Because it's, like, she's a real human person, and you're literally having a man speak for her in this context. It's such a bummer.
What an image.
It is such an image. And, like, not intentionally political. Like, that's not the image, message they're trying to send. But, like, when you watch it now, you're like, oh, yeah. I see that. Mm-hmm. That sucks.
Yeah. And it's one of those things as well, is like it is, I think it's very cool that they did fall into these, like, Japanese theatrical styles.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also like Western theatrical styles also required, like, all parts to be played by men at a certain point of time.
Mm-hmm.
And there are ways to, like, be historically accurate and or, like, pull from a culture without reinforcing negative aspects of that culture. Like, there's a difference between being, like, culturally sensitive and just, like, reinforcing the same patriarchal rules that exist almost everywhere.
100%. And also for street cred, there are troops and traditions in Japan that are made up of entirely women that also are kabuki style and bunraku. There's, like, the key difference actually, street, like, nerd, here we go. The difference between male bunraku and female bunraku styles is that the men, they have three operators to a puppet, and the women, they do the entire operation themselves. So, like, the puppet is, like, attached in a harness to the front of their body, and then they manipulate the arms and legs and head using their own appendages,
mm-hmm.
which is an entirely separate and difficult, like, display of puppetry. And, of course, because of the patriarchy, universally, like, not recognized as equal to male bunraku.
Wow.
Which is why when Harold Prince was like, oh, what's, like, theatrical styles of Japan? He stumbled on all of the men, the male-dominated styles, and none of the women-dominated styles. Because, like, still in the 70s, like, feminism hadn't hit that hard yet, where people were like, these women artists are equally talented, and the art is equally good, and you don't need to separate them because that is sexist and terrible.
Here we are.
And here we are.
We've touched on this a little bit, but there have been interesting directions taken in different revivals of it. Like, you've talked about different revivals that actually use women playing female characters.
Mm-hmm.
But there was also a very successful revival of it that happened in Japan, which I find fascinating.
Yes. There was a Japanese language production, I believe, produced in the early 2000s, and that was produced at their new National Theater. And that production served as the basis for the 2004 Broadway revival. When they came to Broadway, they replaced the cast with Asian American actors and they performed it in English. But, like, the designs and a lot of the adaptations that they took were the same, including at the end of Next, which is the song that closes the show. In the original, there was this, like, music break where, as, like, a gag, because we're living in the 1970s, two young people walked on, listen, like with headphones, and there was completely silent, but they were like dancing like they were listening to the best music ever. And there's like, it's like a gag because they're like dancing incredibly, but they're not listening to anything. Like, we can't hear it. And in that part of the score in the 2004 revival, there's literally like a bomb that explodes on stage, and like some of the set crumbles and everyone's just like on the floor, which is definitely meant to represent not only like the devastation and like destruction of the industrialization of the war machine in the 20th century, but like probably specifically the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki in World War II. And then slowly they like start to rebuild everything and finish the song just as strongly as it was intended. And like, that is the kind of like hard-hitting political messaging that just like makes me stand up and applaud the genre of musical theater, because like you get an audience of people who are like going to the Roundabout Theater Company, so like pretty like well-to-do New Yorkers, and then you sit them in a room for 2.5 hours and make them examine like the ways in which the U.S. relations with Japan have been exploitative and like destructive of the culture, and then like remind them about one of the worst devastations that ever happened in the 20th century, all while they're singing, acting, and dancing. Mm-hmm. And it's just like that unity of like political messaging and art is one of the most powerful things that I think exists in like the musical canon. There was also, not to be shady, a production of Pacific Overtures that employed white people in the roles of the Westerners. It started, I believe it started at Chicago Shakespeare Theater in 2001, and then toured around for a bit, Trans-Dunmar Warehouse in London, won a bunch of awards. I'm sure it was beautiful. I'm sure it was a great production. But when I heard about that, I was really disappointed. One, because there's like how many shows for all Asian casts, and you had to take that away from them, A. And B, on a more serious note, one of the coolest aspects of the show is that it really examines this moment in history from the Japanese perspective. And for 2.5 hours, everybody you see on stage looks like they're Japanese, like belongs in that culture. Even the people who are playing Admiral Perry and the sailors who are like white people are doing it like in whiteface. And so you have that amazing moment of like, these actors have definitely in their careers been turned down for roles because they were Asian, even though they were like Asian roles. They're like, we're going to give this to some white person because they'll sell better.
Like Emma Stone.
Like, yikes, Emma Stone, she's sorry. But like exactly that moment of, for so many years, like Asian people have been not even allowed to play themselves or only play themselves in like really cartoonishly stereotypical ways. And now they have this amazing story where they're like talking about like a huge moment in the history of the nation of Japan, and also like taking back some of the power that they had lost in presenting their version of our side of the story, which is just an incredible moment when you're like, oh, like even in this production, the white people are going to be Japanese. It's just like astounding. And I'm white, but I could only imagine like what it would feel like if you were like Asian and you were watching a show about watching a show with an entirely Asian cast, and finally like realizing yourself in all of these different people in a way that you can't do that in a lot of media today because there just isn't that kind of representation visually. And it makes me really sad to see revivals like that, partly because it's just like, that's the name of the game, yo. Like, it's like casting Othello as not a white, as a, like a white person, not like a person of color who's black. Like, it's literally the point of the piece is to examine this. Mm-hmm. And if you're choosing not to do that, then why are you doing the show in the first place?
One really interesting aspect of that is going back to what we were talking about at the very beginning about like the creators of this show being white men. Mm. Because everything that you were talking about, like with the story being from the perspective of the Japanese, it raises this meta question of like, is it the perspective of the Japanese? Like, technically, no. Like, that's why I think that the production in Tokyo was so interesting to me as well, because like that actually had like not only input and like creative direction from Japanese people, but like not even Japanese American, like born and raised in Japan, like experiencing their own history and culture, and putting that back into the work in a way that you can't, like, as a white person in America, or even like perhaps even a Japanese American person born and raised in America, because you don't have the same cultural understanding.
Totally. I'm nodding my head so hard for listeners at home. Like, I 100% agree with what you said. It's also like in the history of like the musical as like an art form in Japan, really fascinating, because one of the things, like, Japan has really embraced American musical theater, like, as like a cultural convention. Like, there's a ton of shows that have like Japanese productions or like American productions that travel over to Japan. Like, it's a hit over there. And so it's really it's really fascinating to see, like, oh, not only is it just like our popular stuff like Phantom of the Opera and like Wicked, but it's like in like this musical, which is itself like a melding of Japanese and American theater traditions, now like gets another meta layer added to it. Because it's the Japanese interpretation of the American interpretation of the Japanese interpretation of what happened when the Americans landed in Japan. And it also, like, heartens me to see that, like, this musical is produced and written in a way that, like, in the broader sense, there's, like, a Japanese audience for it. Because it would be a huge negative sign for me if, like, people in Japan were like, oh, no, we're not going to do this. We don't like it. Like, that would be a huge red flag. And not to say that, like, that is the only metric of whether or not a thing is problematic, but, like, it does make me breathe a little easier that, like, this musical has been very well received over there.
Mm-hmm. I think that one of the really important things that sets it apart from musicals like South Pacific or Miss Saigon or these kinds of shows, it's, like, you even can, like, read about the motivations behind writing these shows, and it's very much like they wanted to talk about something, and they thought that the sort of Asian backdrop of it made it more interesting and exotic.
Exotic, yes, exactly. Like, yeah. The exotification of, like, oh, we'll do this regular, like, love story, but we'll put it in, like, this cool place.
Yeah.
That'll make it different and interesting.
It'll be so fun and tragic.
Literally, yeah. Tragic exclusively for the Asian people, though. Like, that's, like,
yep.
At Miss Saigon. Like, it'll be tragic for everybody who lives in Vietnam, and everybody who's American will have, like, a rough day, but then get home just fine.
Mm-hmm. And there are definitely aspects of Pacific overtures that can be interpreted as, like, exoticizing different aspects of Japan as well.
Totally.
But on the base level, it is telling a story that is very specific, and it's not a story that could exist. It's not using Japan, like, as a backdrop for a universal story. It is the story of Japan.
Correct. And it is, like, a story that the authors were really determined to tell honestly. And there's this great story that leads into Stephen Sondheim's Steve, my good friend Steve, his favorite song that he's ever written, which is in this show called Someone in a Tree. When the Americans came onto the beach and they had the mats rolled out, there's the American side of what happened, like the historical record, but there isn't actually a record of what the Japanese delegation said or thought or did. Like, there's only the American record and not a Japanese record. And so that posed a problem to the writers because they didn't have anything to go off of. And Hal Prince famously said, and so we'll have a song there. Which is, like, classic him to be like, oh, we have a huge theatrical problem. We'll just sing about it and move on. And so what Stephen Sondheim did was he was like, I have to, like, write a song about nothing. And what came out of that was, A, the narrator tells the audience, there's no Japanese record of what's happening in this hut right now. We don't know. It's a shame. And then somebody walks on stage and he's like, well, actually, I was there. And then there's this whole song about this individual who was a little boy at the time who's, like, climbing a tree and, like, looked into the hut and saw what was happening. And then from under the hut, there's a samurai who's like, well, I'm also here. And I was a samurai. I was listening to them the whole time. And, like, if they knocked, I was going to, like, jump through the floorboards and, like, cut all those Americans down because, like, they weren't suckers. They knew. So this musical number that comes out of this where they're talking about how some of the most important events in history are not actually about the important things in history, but they're really about all the details and all the little things that happen. And there's this like repeating motif in the song, in the lyrics, about like it's not the building but the beam, not the pebble but not the stream, the pebble, like all of the little things that are actually adding up to be this big thing, and it's not a big thing in and of itself. And like, if the person watching hadn't been there, since everything affects everything, it might not have gone the same way. And if the samurai underneath, even though he never like came up and did anything, if he wasn't there, it might have gone totally differently. And it's just this like amazingly profound like philosophy of life, which came out of the authors not wanting to be like, oh, well, we should probably invent something that happens. They were like, no, like, let's just be truthful and just like wax poetic for a minute about like what it truly means to like not have an account of something, and then like, what is this all actually about? Because like, truthfully, the negotiation is like historically kind of boring. All of the exciting stuff happened around it, where they were like, you can't come, you can't come, and they finally came, and then they talked, and then they left. It was an afternoon. It was a brunch. But like, and then it's one of the most profound musical theater songs I've ever listened to. And I listen to it all the time, because I'll come out of it and be like, oh, this is what the song is about. And then I'll listen to it again and be like, no, it's about another thing. And it is just an incredible song, and Steve's favorite, which I think is really fascinating, because it's not from one of his, you know, it's not his most popular song of all time. And it's not like a song that made him a lot of money. His favorite song is the song that he wrote for the show that nobody heard about nothing.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if Sondheim himself is like a Sondheim hipster. He's like, no, I can't do the more popular pieces.
He's like, I won't be coming to your concert unless you do Something from a Tree. Like, I won't. I can't be bothered.
Sweeney Todd, who's that?
Literally sick of it. He's just like, oh, that demon barber again? No, I can't.
Can't be bothered. All right, I'm sure we could talk about this for hours, but at this point, I think it's time to head to the lightning round.
Okay, I'm ready.
So to start off with, what is your favorite song?
My favorite song in this show is called Pretty Lady. It is the perfect example of Sondheim writing a song that is musically one thing and dramatically another. The song is a beautiful three-person chorale with like parallel fourths underneath it, which is like just like a Japanese style of like unending music. And then this Western chorale of three sailors all hitting on this woman. And like the music itself is very lyrical and like poetic. And the lyrics are saying about like, oh, I've been on this ship and it's dirty and it's lonely and I really want to be with you. Meanwhile, dramatically, they're like invading this woman's garden, crashing her home, offering her money, and like thinking that she's a prostitute. And so it is a fantastic encapsulation of what the show is about, which is the melding of American and Japanese theatrical traditions, and also like Americans literally thinking of something is so great that they want a piece of it without realizing that they're hurting it in the process.
Beautiful. And what is your favorite line in the show?
My favorite line comes at the end of Four Black Dragons, which is the song where the Japanese people see the ships coming into the harbor. And it's the end of the song where all the chorus of people are singing, and I thought it was the end of the world, and then the music cuts out, and one single person says, and it was.
Ooh.
Which is like, yep, that's how that experience must have felt. Ooh. And like, historically speaking, it totally was the end of the Japanese world at that moment.
Ooh. Who's your favorite character?
It's tough. When I watched it in preparation for this, my favorite character, and I'm terrible with names, so that's why I haven't been using anyone's names in this whole podcast, besides my good friend Steve, is the man who left for Massachusetts and came back and then became a samurai. I think he's my favorite character because he has the most interesting journey, because you don't expect it. Because at the beginning of the play, you're like, oh yeah, he's just like the westernizing force. But in Act 2, he really becomes like a conservative force, And he really is like, I grew up and I realized I was just being an petulant kid. And like, this is actually dangerous for us and our culture. And like, we have to stop this. And then he like is one of the few people in the show who like directly acts on his like intentions of saving the world, basically. And I just think that his character is so fascinating.
So my next standard question is, who would you want to play in a production of this? And we've kind of covered that a little bit. Mm-hmm. So feel free to interpret this how you will.
Yeah. My favorite person that I would want to be in a production of this is the dramaturg in the lobby, who's like, I want to talk to you patrons about this show because I'm a white person and you can see that I care about this. And you, because most people in the theater are white people, patrons that is. And I'd be like, yeah, come and talk to me about this show. I will tell you everything that is you're going to love, and I'm going to tell you things that you're going to be afraid of, but then you're going to see it and you're not going to be afraid of it anymore. I will not be on stage. I've also, like, I am a director, like, as a craft, and I've always imagined what I would do to direct the show, but I've also always, like, been like, and I probably won't ever do it because I think that most adaptations and most performances of this show really should be helmed by Japanese people as, like, a way of, like, continuing to have people financially and like artistically benefit from this show who are the people the show is about.
Very good answer. Very good.
Thank you.
Who would you recommend go see this show specifically?
I would recommend, firstly, if you are an Asian American person and you don't know about this show, go see it. If you are an American person and you've ever once in your life said, America is great, you need to see this musical and you need to see more musicals and just more culture in general about the legacy of America's like expedition into extraterritorialism, because this is not going to change the world in a meaningful way, but like we need as an American society to like continue to remind ourselves that we have done things that we are mad at other people for doing. One of those things is invading other countries and reworking their systems.
Yeah, we're really good at that, and it's not good.
And the other thing we're really good at is pretending like it didn't happen.
Oh, yeah.
Because, like, if you ask people on the street today, you'd be like, how do you feel about Admiral Perry's exploration into Japan and opening up that market forcibly into the trading agreements that we have today? They would be like, I don't know that that's a thing that ever happened. And he would be like, well,
listen, I saw the History of Japan video.
That's true. So the 45 million people who have seen that video will know what I'm talking about. Oh, yeah.
Said,
if you've seen the History of
borders.
Japan, you need to see this because it's clear that you're going to enjoy long explorations of the Japanese culture and history. So see this.
America said, open your borders. Stop having them be closed.
Stop. Literally.
Knock, knock. It's the United States.
It's literally what happened. That's the thing, is that, like, that video is so funny and so, like off the cuff. But, like, everything that happened in that video is, like, exactly what happened. And it's
extraordinarily well-researched.
Extraordinarily well-researched. Very well done. A huge influence on meme culture. And I approve.
All right. Great. Had to bring it back to the History of Japan video. Mm-hmm. And then finally, if you could combine this show with another one, what would you pick?
If I were like to somehow create a double bill that wouldn't fully exhaust my audience, I would combine it with Allegiance, which is the other notable musical about the Japanese experience in relationship to America. And I would do it sort of like as a, here was the conversation around Japanese, like the Japanese-American exchange in the 1970s, and here is the conversation about the Japanese-American exchange in the 2010s, and just like to juxtapose those, and also like to look at like what the differences of narrative are when you have like writers who are white, writers who are Japanese, like something that is a lived experience for people like George Takei, and like something that is a historical event that has been well researched, and just like what that does differently to the art that's created, and also just to like look at the differences of like musical theater in 50 or so years, however many years it's been since those two works were staged on Broadway.
Wow, I really want to see that now. Seems really interesting.
Not that I would ever advocate that anybody go around the United States copyright system, but Allegiance was filmed for broadcast for live cinemas. So I can imagine if you know any pirates out there that there's probably a copy of that pro shoot floating around on the tubes of the internet.
And as you know, on this show, we never admit to watching bootlegs.
I would never. I went, I got a time machine, traveled back to 1976 and saw the original production, and then I used that time machine for the Double Miles and went to 2004 and saw the revival. I have never, ever in my life seen a bootleg. I don't know what you're talking about. Don't at me.
All right. Thank you so much for talking with me today.
Of course. It was my pleasure.
And thank you all for listening. Goodbye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Corner of the Sky. You can find us online at theincomparable.com/COTS or follow us on Twitter at COTS Podcast. If you would like, you could also review us on Apple Podcast or recommend us on Overcast. See you next week.